Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's April 12th, 2013. You're listening to the best poker cast on the interwebs. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
How are things going, buddy?
Not bad. We're in the middle of this home renovation here at Stately Long Manor.
Yeah.
And so getting ready to, do the front of the house over, new landscaping and deck and things like that, right? Mm-hmm. And we have let's look at this mailbox that we have, right?
Right.
And you've seen it. And I don't know. I'm pretty sure I talked about this on the show years ago, but I don't really remember. But this mailbox that I have, I bought with the winnings from the first tournament I ever cashed in.
I think you mentioned that once.
Yes. And it was a lot more money than my wife wanted to spend, but I'm like, you know what? I'm going to buy it. I'm using my money that I won at the poker table. So talk to the hand. Well, now it's obviously been several years, and then it's wood, and it's rotted away, and so now we need to replace it because everything else is looking nice, right?
Right.
So I told the wife, you know what, I'm just going to replace it. I'm going to get the same one. And she's like, that's ridiculous. You spent way too much money on it the first time. I don't know why you got to spend that much money on it anytime. And then she sends me this link to a white mailbox on eBay for $11.99. She's like, buy this. here's the... I'm getting all choked up.
I'll fill the time with a joke.
Oh, man. Oh, we're really in trouble then.
I got a real good joke. It's not poker, though, so... Why don't
boxes walk into a bar?
Well, how about this? Why don't cannibals eat comedians?
I do not know.
Because they taste funny. It's a cute joke. Can't really offend anybody, except maybe comedians and cannibals. But I doubt it.
Or fourth graders that have... advanced humor.
I'm trying to fill the lull while you have an attack.
Yeah, well, I think I'm over my allergic reaction here to this, so
all right.
Pick back up where I was. So now I'm in this pickle now.
I don't know what's funnier, what's going to be the story, or you're just hacking and dying over there. I got to look for my insurance policies here.
So I'm in this pickle now. Oh my God, this is crazy. Where... I have this emotional attachment to this mailbox because of what it stands for in my very weak poker career.
Your poker career's not that weak.
Well, it's not tremendous. I mean, this tournament, here's what's funny about this tournament, is I've had only one cash bigger than this tournament in my life. And that was my very first cash.
No, see, now you're lying.
I don't think so.
Yeah, so you cashed down in Palm Beach for a bunch that time. It was an Ante Up event, and then you cashed at the Ante Up event in Immokalee, and come on. Yeah. Don't embellish. It's going to be a good story. You don't need to lie.
I didn't mean to embellish. I just forgot. I'm like all poker players. I remember my losses. I don't remember my wins. But anyhow, so here's the thing is I just feel like it's going to be a little part of my ego, my success or whatever, to just plow over this trophy and put up a $11.99 eBay mailbox.
Right. Your legacy, right? It's your legacy.
Exactly. So if it costs me another $300 or $400 for another mailbox, which is ridiculous, I know. For some part of me, it's, when I pull back up to Stately Long Manor, I look at the mailbox, and I'm like, I won that. Of course, that one that I'm replacing with, I didn't win. I just kind of... pay for it to replace the one I won with.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just feel kind of weird that, this is like, space talk to the wife. I don't get it. I don't understand. It's a stupid mailbox. Don't need to spend all this money on a mailbox.
So really, though, you spent like that much money on the first mailbox?
It was like $350. Yeah. It was
holy cow! Is that even possible?
It is possible, because here's the thing: is I went to try to find the company that did it, and I couldn't find them. And then I actually found a poker buddy that's in the mailbox business, and he's like, "I'll give you a good quote." And he gave me a good quote on a mailbox that looks nothing like mine, nowhere near as it is nice as it is. And it's $500 now.
Oh my god!
For a mailbox.
I gotta tell you, man, I've been going to your house for what, 6, 7 years? 7 years, maybe 8. No, 7. And I never even noticed your mailbox. I still haven't. The only thing I noticed once was that you told me that your dad ran it over or something, and I wanted to try to see, or whoever, and I wanted to try to see, like if there was still signs of like tire marks on it or something. And I still can't even remember what the mailbox looked like. And you spent all that money on it. Wow.
Backed right into it. Now there's a couple of lizards living in it.
So what'd you settle on then?
We haven't settled on anything yet. Actually, I think what we settled on is I'm going to have my handyman salvage the part I like. Because it's got our address carved in there, and it's painted to match the house. And
yeah.
So I'm going to have him try to salvage that and build me a new mailbox. Hopefully a lot cheaper.
Yeah, that's cool. Oh.
But do you have any kind of non-trophy poker trophies in your house?
Just my wife.
Oh, very nice.
No, really, I no. I mean, I've taken a lot of, like, to be honest, the house itself, I used to do this on the blog when we were back at the Times, all the money I won online when it was soft paid off my house.
Right.
So that's kind of...
your house, essentially.
My house is the trophy, I guess, yeah. It helped me pay off the back end of the mortgage. But no, I'm nothing that sentimental like that. I have some aquariums in the house that I've won with the money, with the home game money. Pretty much the aquariums that I've bought in this house have all been from courtesy of you guys. So I guess every time I look at the aquariums, I think, oh, look, there's the time I took Scott for...
Yeah, but that's essentially coming out of your bank account,
yeah,
which is funded by poker, right? Yeah. It wasn't a direct, I am going to buy this thing for me directly from my poker winnings.
Well, no, that's not true. I mean, I think... I have a bankroll. I don't go to my ATM and take my money out. I think we had this conversation with Kenna James years ago. I mean, I have the safe.
Yeah, but again, it's the same thing, though. I mean, you're not really buying anything then at that point from your bankroll then.
No,
say you paid off your house then.
Like, in other words, when I come home from the home game and I have $200 or $300 that I won, I take that money and I go buy
something. Dollars? We play for Skittles.
I asked the guy at the store, will you take 300 Skittles for that nice aquarium? And then he says yes. And then I say, okay, thank you, home game. But I don't think I ever took a tournament winnings and went out and bought something with it and was sentimental with it now. Never really did that.
Well, that's what I'm curious, whether any of our listeners have something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, you know, hey, I had a good run at the table today. I am going to get something specific. And then you just... You know, I'm always going to remember that mailbox came from a tournament.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think I have anything else really like that around the house, so. Yeah. And now it's being taken away from me.
And being replaced by a white $11 piece of crap. well, speaking of replacing things, I'd like to talk about the Poker Tournament Directors Association. Not replacing them, but some of their rules. And, you know, they have that once every 2 year rules summit that they always have at Vegas during the World Series time in late June. This year it's going to be at the Venetian. And I don't know if we can do anything about it, but I'm sure that they're listening to us, or at least people like us, when it comes to what to change, what to adjust, and whatever. So I'm just wondering, are there any rules that... The first one comes to mind to me that I think they should change is what happened last year at the World Series with that Karaknai guy and the woman that finished 10th. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, I remember it as World Series Rule 89. I don't really recall the number that's TDA related to it. But that was the main rule that I think really needs to be addressed. You know, that someone else's cards get mucked and this guy gets his money back and doesn't lose the tournament and blah, blah, blah. But it's amazing, first of all, the TDA's get-together summit or whatever is already here again.
Yeah, it seemed like it was last week.
I thought it was last year. I mean, I can't believe it really was 2 years ago. That's crazy. I, could have sworn it was last year. Man.
And you know, it's funny too, is not that I expect them to have this annually, but you would think that they'd have enough to discuss to do it annually, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you're all going to be there anyway. It's the World Series. You know, they're almost always going to be out there. Most of the people who are involved in it are going to be there anyway. I just can't believe it's gone by that fast. So what do you think? Yeah. Is there anything that's been in your craw about the rules in the last 2 years?
I have a pretty big craw, so. you know, nothing that's really come up. I haven't been as vehement about that World Series ruling as others. Not that that just means that I don't think it was wrong or needs to be changed, but it just never really bothered me as much as it did other people. Overall, I think the TDA is a pretty good document. I mean, and the one thing that does, I think, ends up causing us most of the trouble when we talk about the call of floor is also the thing that they will never change, I don't think. It's that rule number one, you know?
Yeah.
You go back and, you know, okay, so you've got, you know, 190 other rules here, but if you end up ruling based off that and you don't think it's good for the game, then you don't have to.
Yeah.
Is this get out of jail free card, and it's tough because you know I understand why it's there, and there's lots of examples, and we talk about them on the show every week. That okay, this is what really should happen, but in this case, I think it's all right if we do this. So I don't want to change it, but at the same time, it always seems weird to me that there's that ruling. I mean, I don't think you have that, like, you know, I'm not a football ref or a baseball umpire, but I'm not. It can't come up with anything. And those type of rules where, you know what? I think that guy meant to tag that guy out. So for the good of the game, I'm going to call you out, all right? It just doesn't happen, right?
He didn't mean to hold him.
Yeah.
No 10 yards for holding.
So, you know, that would be the only thing. But, you know, I don't really know what you do to adjust it. You know?
Here's what I say, and I propose this. Rule one is the rule. Rules 2 through 190, at the end of each rule, they write J/K, and then asterisk, see rule 1. That's what you say at the end of every other rule. Just kidding. Just do what you want. Because that's essentially what they do. If they don't, you know, if they feel like something's going to happen where if I make the ruling that should be carved in stone, you know, the place is going to blow up, so let me just go to rule 1 and say, it's all right, you get a pass. So,
yeah.
You know, it's not a rule if you don't follow it. It's just a suggestion. It's the TDA suggestions.
It's a guidepost.
Yeah, yeah. But really, though, it is a great document, and, you know, let's just try to make them a little more concrete. But other than that, so if you have any suggestions, let us know. Maybe we'll pass them along for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to hear what other people want to see addressed, and then we give something more to talk about. Then just change rule number one. But don't.
Change it, but don't. All right, our hotline, 813-448-1120. You use it, we'll give you something. And I love it when our ambassadors call in. This is our good friend Don Matasovsky from St. Louis.
And I have a question that comes from subbing in for a player in a poker club. The 40-man tournament pays cash for the top 5 places and earns club points based on finishing position. Point leaders win WSOP seats at the end of the season. What is the proper approach to take when points are as important as the chance to cash? This is a deep stack structure, and I had 27,000 chips with blinds at 1,000, 2,000 with a 300 ante, and I was in the big blind. Middle position raises to 15,000, folds to me, and I have ace-king offsuit. This player made a move earlier where he had made a big raise with 3-6 offsuit, called my all-in to double me up. I have a good starting hand and already have about 8.5% on my stack in the pot. I'm in the blind, so my effective M is only about 4. I shove for 12,000 more, and he calls. He has 10-10, and his hand holds up. My decision was based on needing enough chips to get to a cashing position. Should I have sat on my hands and played out my 4 rotations and moved up in the ranks or pushed to try to double up and have a chance of cashing?
Very good question.
Is it St. Louis?
I don't know.
So it's St. Louis.
Nah, whatever. It's St. Louis.
St. Louis.
But really, though, I have to say that I think he played it correctly. I would definitely just play to move up. Because here's the deal. You could have moved up a little bit and got points but not cashed. But you could have moved up, got cash, and gotten more points, and you played effectively. If what he said was right about his effective M being 4, which I thought it was bigger than that, but it might have been 4. I really wasn't doing the math as I was listening that fast, but I think he played it right. Yeah, I'm not good at math. That's why I designed the magazine and not the numbers.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, I guess what struck me is in the scenario he gave, take the points out of it, I think you still make the same decision.
Yeah, M of 4 and you got Ace King. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's just and you're in position, that's just a good spot there to do that regardless of what's going on. And I think if you get fixated on the points and you're folding hands like Ace King in really good situations like that, then I think you're making some mistakes.
Plus, now, we had the added information that the guy made a move too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that you know, if guys have made a move in the past too, so you've got even added information that there's nothing wrong with that move. So, but you're right. I don't know what the points mean. I don't know the value of the points and how many points he needs to move up to this World Series seed or whatever it is that they're getting. So.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, getting enough points in this tournament gets them to that $10,000 seat, where not getting that enough means he gets a ski ball ticket from Chuck E. Cheese. Then at that point, then it changes everything, I think. So, I mean, I guess, yeah. So we're missing some important information.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of a super satellite and a regular satellite where, all right, do I fold my aces because I only have to move up one spot and I'm tournament chip leader? Or do I have to win first place to win my seat and I'm in 100th place right now? You know what I mean? So there's definitely some differences between the situations. So.
But even that, and this is a short stack ninja in me talking, even at that, you don't have a lot of options left here if you keep folding premium hands like that just to get a few points. I mean, at some point, you're going to have to get it all in. You're probably going to have to get it all in 2 or 3 times with less strong hands than this and poorer situations. So regardless, at this point, I think you need to get it in and not worry about, because you're just going to cause yourself bigger problems later on.
Agreed.
All right, Don, we've used something from you in the last year, but remind everybody else, call the hotline at 813-448-1120, and we'll send you something wonderful like a copy of the ebook, You Called Me With What? By Rick Danford, which is available for just $1.99 on Amazon.com.
Ah, the whole nation's disappointed. what are you going to do? All right, we got a mailbag this week. Comes from Todd Falstad, and he says, I have the great fortune of traveling for a living as an airline pilot. I could control my schedule to the point of being in certain cities on certain days. In other words, zero travel rake. I've been moving up to larger games when they are available, but often it's whatever is being dealt. Can you suggest any strategies that might help with gapping up to bigger and or more frequent winning sessions, given that every time I sit down, it's with hard-to-range unknown opponents in a different room? I've caught myself gambling a bit more often lately to try to make up for variance. Don't do that.
Yeah.
That's the first thing I'll tell you. Don't do that.
Well, I love this email. One, you know, I had to edit it down a little bit, but he said he's one of these old guys that just learn what podcasts are, and then a bunch of them are crap, but he likes ours, so.
Cool.
Thanks, Todd. And then the places that he's flown are amazing. I really kind of want to get his job, other than the fact that I don't want to be an airline pilot.
And it was maybe a long list, too, right? It was a huge list of places that
you're going. You know, unless I could be like that Leonardo DiCaprio pilot, you know, where you're faking pilot. Yeah.
You're just sitting in that chair, a jumper or whatever they call it.
So what I told him is good news and bad news here. I mean, the bad news is, I think, being in a different room every night in a different, completely different city setting and everything, I think really you are kind of constrained to play ABC poker for the most part and not get out of line, because if you start trying to adjust on a nightly basis to people that are completely different that you don't really have any experience with, that's when I think you're going to make a ton of more mistakes. I think it's not as exciting to play ABC, but that's probably the way you're going to do if you're this. I mean, it's completely different if you're just going to your local room every day for the rest of your life.
Mm.
Then you can get much more creative because you know how everything's going to work there. But, you know, if you have the great fortune, as he said, of playing in a different room in a different country every single night, then one of the downfalls to that exciting life is that your poker is probably a little bit more boring. Now, the good side of that, I told him, is that he's going to be a phenomenally more diverse poker player with the experiences that he has. You know, you go to like the World Series, then when you have the entire world there playing, he's going to be used to so many different playing styles and things like that, that at that point, in that setting, I think that's going to become a huge advantage to him. But if he's trying to get cute and do it in individual cities, I just don't know if that's going to pay off. And it sounds like it's not right now, he says.
Do you think that's true, though? If you're always playing ABC Poker and just playing the cards that you have and not really, how are you really going to learn about the other people's styles and stuff and combating those styles and adjusting to them when you're still just playing ABC all the time?
Well, let me clarify. I guess I shouldn't have said ABC. What I meant was not trying to become a chameleon and play these other people's style until you understand that style.
Okay.
Just because you don't play a particular style doesn't mean you can't learn nothing. I mean, I am not a lag. I'm never going to be a lag, you know, a loose aggressive player.
Right.
But that doesn't mean I don't watch these people when they play and try to learn how they play and the advantages and weaknesses of it. I think you can learn a lot just from observing and not really trying it out.
Sure.
So, I mean, remember, there's other places you can try it out, too. I mean, you can go on, you know, PokerStars home games and play for free and try some crazy stuff out just to see how it works later on. So, I mean, you just don't have to have your education at the University of Hard Knocks at the actual table with a bunch of money on the line.
Yeah. Well, the hard part in this email to me is just that he's asking for a strategy that will help him win more. And I don't know if what you're suggesting.
The strategy is to get a boring 9-to-5 cubicle job like most everybody else does. Play the same place. So
yeah, that's right.
You know, it's almost one of these things, and he's certainly not complaining. So I don't want anybody to think that I'm saying he's complaining, but it's one of these things where he's just so fortunate to have this lifestyle that he has that, you know, you kind of want the cake and eat it too. And sometimes you just have to be happy with the great things you have in your life and just know that some things are not going to be quite as great as you'd like them to be. You know, that being said, I mean, you keep going back to the same places. I mean, if you are very observant and take good notes, you know, I mean, for example, when I go to Mississippi, I can't really put my finger on it, but there's a different style of play there. And I've been there enough now that when I go there, I'm like, yeah, I'm back in Mississippi, so I'm going to have to adjust this way or this way. Same with California, too. I mean, California is very different, particularly in L.A.
Yeah.
So those are things that I picked up just in my brief travels. This guy obviously has seen far more of the world than I have. So, you know, it's not a life sentence to ABC Poker. You know, it's just, you know, being patient and taking good notes and remembering how people play in those areas, and when you come back to North Dakota or wherever, then eventually you're going to remember that style and be able to pick up and play it.
Yeah, you know, I know what you're talking about, too, about the regional part of stuff, you know, when you're in a certain area and they seem to play a certain way. But it does sound like Todd plays smaller stakes. I think that you know, from in all of my travels to play poker, it doesn't seem to me like the 1-2 game is that different from state to state. I mean, there may be certain styles or days of the week where people are getting it all in on draws, or, you know, they're really, really bad and their eyes light up when you can obviously know they just flop three of a kind, or, you know, or something like that. But generally, you know, it's the only game out there for the beginner. They can't go any lower than that for the most part. Sometimes it's a 1-1 game or whatever, but really we're facing 1-2 everywhere we go because that's as low as they can go. So you're going to come across those players, and the games are very similar from no matter where you're playing when it comes to 1-2 no limit, if that's what he's playing, or something like that. So
yeah,
maybe
I did
adjust to that.
Yeah, I edited out the email. Again, I hate editing emails, particularly really good ones, but, you know, no one wants to hear us read 4 hours, but... But he did mention that, you know, sometimes, you know, he's stuck playing a game or a limit that he may not be comfortable with because that's the only game in that room.
Yeah.
So, I mean, again, I think that's part of the diversity. I mean, you're forced to play, learn different things, so you may not be very successful if it's You know, the only game going on tonight is 24-E limit, and that's not what you play, but you want to play poker because that's what you're there for. You're eventually going to become a better poker player because of it, even if that one session might end up being more brutal than 2-5 no limit or whatever you'd normally play.
Yeah, I'd love to play 20-40. Sense. I meant sense. Bring back online poker.
Skittles. All right, Todd. Well, we appreciate the great email. Think about us when you're flying around the world. And we are going to make your... of course, you know, we don't want you to read this when you're flying. That's bad, right? Unless you have autopilot.
Yeah,
I mean, does autopilot really exist?
Yeah, I don't think there really are pilots behind that door anymore.
Hmm.
I think there's guys in there just having a party while the plane flies itself.
All right, well, when you're on autopilot, Todd, we're going to send you Pot Odds Made Simple. It's a seminar from poker instructor Thomas Gallagher, which can be downloaded to any mobile device. Folks, you can get your own by mentioning AnteUp at poker911.net.
Hey, we got a feedback this week in the form of an audio clip. Don't usually get that, but we do get it a lot from Mr. No Swag, who makes an appearance again.
Hello, boys. Mr. No Swag here. Just wanted to give you a buzz listening to the most recent episode, and wanted to make a quick comment on Greg Raymer. I don't think Greg Raymer fell from grace. If you know anything about Greg Raymer, and I happen to have a passing acquaintance with the gentleman, he is a libertarian, and he is all in favor of, you know, deregulation of prostitution, decriminalization, actually. Not regulation, decriminalization of prostitution, drugs, you know, things like that. So this kind of falls right within his beliefs. And anyway, I just wanted to make the comment that, you know what, I don't think it's any of our business who's having sex with who.
Well, there's, you can say what you believe in, doesn't make it legal.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, I think it might be a little bit of tongue-in-cheek here, but I don't know. But at the same time, you know, just because you believe that something is what should be happening and should be illegal doesn't make it legal, and doesn't mean you should be able to do it just because you believe in it.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that people that don't share that same view aren't going to still look down on you.
Yeah,
you
that's
know?
True, too.
And that was kind of the point we made, you know.
Yeah.
You know, what I thought was interesting is we did get some feedback from people that just really thought this was a non-story.
Yeah.
And I really don't think, no matter what your political beliefs are, that, you know, something like this is a non-story, you know, because there are people that do make it a story. Now, it could be, you know, people saying, you know, this is not as big of a story as these people are making it out to be, and that's a completely different argument. But yeah, you're right. I mean, just, you know, just because, you know, this should be something that's decriminalized doesn't mean that it's, hey, you know what? This is what I believe, so you can't arrest me.
That's right. I love to smoke marijuana, so I'm going to do it, and you can't arrest me.
No. Yeah, I love that. You know, you're going to show up at the catch a predator thing with the hooker, and you're under arrest. Hold on, here's my libertarian card. Ah, drats! Thought we were going to catch somebody today, but nope, you're free to go.
Diplomatic immunity. Mel Gibson, you cannot shoot me in the head. The first movie was good. The second was okay. After that, they should have stopped making them.
Yeah, there's like 20 of them now, right?
I know. There's way too many.
And I can't keep any of them a separate. They're all, I'm like, oh, Lethal Weapon 47's on. Is that the... no, it's actually 41 tonight.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the only way I can ever remember it's the first one is just because they're just getting to know each other. After that, I don't know what movie it is anymore. It's just crazy. But Mr. No Swag, I'm going to respectfully disagree with you.
There we go. We can be very respectful.
Yeah. Hey, we've got some housekeeping here. They're running Aces Harness Park. Is running the Antioch Poker Tour right now as we speak.
That's
so exciting.
Right now as we speak.
Well, not as we speak, but as people listen.
33 minutes right now.
As people listen to the
yes,
show.
Because
it,
yes.
It won't be uploaded until it's running. So thanks for spoiling it. But it has begun the Antioch Midwest Championship. Of course, it's an Antioch Poker Tour series. And it runs through April 21st. Our Minnesota ambassador, Poker Geek MN, who has just been incredible with promoting this with us and Twitter and whatever social media he gets his hands on. He's going to be there all week. And, of course, Scott's going to be there. And our good friends from Fifth Street Radio They're going to be there for the main event. So information can be found at antiupmagazine.com/runningaces. And don't forget, Downstream Casino Resort will host its Four States Poker Championship Antiup Poker Tour event May 17th to the 26th and has posted its schedule at antiupmagazine.com/downstream. More details on all AUPT events, including the Antiup Poker Tour World Championship, can be found at antiuppokertour.com.
Wallace Schakowsky Jr., Antiup's 2010 Player of the Year and a single table specialist, is still the pro on our May 20th Antiup Poker Cruise out of Miami. That's going to spotlight sit and goes. Rates are no longer guaranteed, but we are still getting people on, but it's getting dicey now.
Yeah,
so
it's getting hard.
Call it soon.
Yes.
And then don't forget, we are sailing out of New York City to Bermuda and out of Tampa to Cozumel and Grand Cayman.
Awesome.
This year. So you can get all the details, including how you can win your way on board at Dover Downs and Palm Beach Kennel Club at antiupcruises.com. And I think you made a good point this morning. You're like, you know, we keep in our ads saying, hey, sail out of Miami. But, you know, maybe the people don't really care. What they want to know is where they're going to go when they get on the ship.
Yeah, that's what gets me excited, because you're going to end up traveling to go to the port anyway, so I want to know where the hell I'm going. Yep. So, yeah, don't forget, New York, you're going to Bermuda, Tampa, going to Cozumel. Okay, so, hey, we've expanded the number of Antiup logo items available for sale on our new Antiup store, including jackets, shirts, hats, and more. And we've consolidated all of our shopping items, subscriptions, single copies, cruises, and products from our trusted partners all into one handy-dandy website, antiupmagazine.com/shop.
Yeah, and people were having a lot of fun with that site. I just shipped out some personalized hats and backpacks this week. So
sweet.
You can really make that stuff look sharp for yourself if you want.
I love wearing my new Antiup hat.
Yeah, how worth it should they give me the other day? So.
I like wearing it backwards because then my head looks really round. And I like having a round head. Okay, we got some big news this week on our Antiup news desk.
The lawyer for Ray Bitar, the only person facing criminal charges in the Full Tilt Poker case, has announced that his client has reached a deal with the U.S. government to spare himself jail time so he can receive a heart transplant. Very few other details on the settlement have been announced, but we'll be waiting for bated breath to learn much more about this.
So, let me ask you, when they say spare him jail time, does that mean some jail time or all the jail time, do you think?
No, he is completely scot-free on the jail, according to what we know. I mean, there hasn't been, like I said, the full details haven't been announced, but from what people are saying is the lawyer essentially went to the court and said, hey, my client has 6 months to a year to live. Wow. He needs a heart transplant. If you put him in jail, then he is taken off of the heart transplant list because prisons can't care for him properly for folks that just had a heart transplant. So you're essentially, you know, sentencing him to death unless you stay out, but we're going to be happy to forfeit all this money and assets you want in exchange for that.
Wow.
So the point I made on Fifth Street Radio this week, and again, I'm not a lawyer, and I know we have a lot of listeners who are, so I'd be interested for them to kind of weigh in. But my understanding from, if you go back, remember the Enron case?
Yes.
Those people just, like, screwed everybody?
Yes.
Well, Ken Lay, one of the big executives, got hit with a huge, massive fine, millions and millions of dollars, right?
Yeah.
And then has a heart attack and dies. And that fine, when you die, is not enforceable at that point. So government can't collect that money.
Hmm.
So if, again, I'm not a lawyer, I don't even play one on TV, but if that same thing applies in this case, I can understand why the government might be interested in trying to get their hands on that money before it's no longer able to get their hands on it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, grim, but it makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a practical solution to a problem here. I mean, obviously, I think I've said this from the beginning. I really thought that they were building their case specifically around Ray Bitar, that he was going to be the guy that they put in jail and the poster child for, you know, who suffered for this. And then obviously take a bunch of money from, you know, the Ray First and Howard Leonard and Chris Ferguson's as well as Ray. But I think at this point, I think, you know, it seems to me, just based on my little knowledge of it, the most prudent way to go if he's really this sick. And he's been on, you know, we've known about his health concerns for quite a while, ever since he was arrested, so.
Right. Wow.
I don't think it's a ruse.
I wonder, if he gets the heart transplant and he's healthy again, do they put him in jail? No, right? Because they're trying to get the money before he dies, and then there is no penalty.
They've, like a settlement, yeah. I guess it's a calculated gamble on both people's part.
Yeah. You know,
maybe I get a heart, and maybe everything works out, and then I'm free and poor. I'll take those chances.
Yeah.
And the government's like, you know what? You know, we'll get the money, and because we don't want to risk not getting the money. And if at least we get the money, and then if he becomes healthy, then, you know, hey, we made the best decision we could at the time. I don't know. Kind of weird, really getting into that. And, you know, what was interesting on Fifth Street, they mentioned that there's so many people out there that are on Twitter and are like, you know, good riddance. Let this guy die.
Yeah.
And that just seems a little crass for me, I think.
Yeah, it's a little harsh.
Isn't it a little crass, maybe?
Yeah, a little harsh.
I think it's just that kind of internet kind of, you can just say whatever you want.
Yeah, anonymity kind of stuff. All right, well, we'll follow the story and keep you guys updated. PokerFuse.com has reported that two Oklahoma Indian tribes have shut down their online gaming sites over a misunderstanding over the legality of the sites. However, a lawyer involved in the case said the tribes are permitted to offer online poker to players not in the United States, with 20% of the revenue going to the state, an opportunity that the tribes are exploring.
Yeah, this is kind of fascinating, and again, I'm going to kind of be a little cautious on it until I see more written about it, because it seems kind of odd, but because I'm not really, I think you get into these whole World Trade Organization problems when you're offering poker to, you know, folks in the United Kingdom, but the folks in Antigua can't offer it to you,
yeah.
U.S. citizens, you know?
Yeah.
And that's always been one of the bigger problems, so again, I'm not a lawyer. I'm really going to have to go to law school pretty soon to do the news desk here, but
yeah.
I think there's some stuff here that maybe people didn't quite understand when the story was written, and you know, we'll see if it plays out that way. All right, and finally, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has heard arguments about whether a mandatory fine of $75,000 for a poker dealer who stole $200 is cruel and unusual punishment. It's not known when the court will render a decision.
This just in, it is.
It is cruel and unusual. Yeah.
If you got somebody who is so desperate for money that they steal $200, they're not going to be able to pay a $75,000 fine. And that's just crazy anyway.
Yeah, okay, well, yeah, and I don't disagree, but I think it's a fascinating argument on both sides. I mean, the argument for it that the state is making is it's purposely outrageous. They set the fine purposely outrageous to discourage people from stealing even a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, I'm going to take $5 out of this pot, but if I get caught, I'm going to have to pay $75,000. You know what? Maybe I'll get a second job. You know, it's not worth it. And if you make that fine, I don't know, $1,000, $100, you know, something more reasonable, then you know, people are going to say, you know what? I don't care. I mean, think about it in terms of speeding. I mean, not that I advocate anybody exceed the speed limit, but, you know, let's say most of us generally go on the freeway 5 miles over, maybe. Doesn't seem like a big deal, right? And part of it's not a big deal because, you know, the fine isn't going to be that bad, or you don't really think anybody's going to catch you going 5 miles over. But if they all of a sudden made the fine $10,000 and you lose your license for a year and put cops all over the freeway, I guarantee you that there'd be very few people going above 65 miles per hour ever. So I think that's what they're going to do in here. And so I can see it from that point of view. But then, yeah, from the other point of view, you know, yeah, I mean, you're essentially just going to impoverish this guy for the rest of his life, and that has all kinds of societal effects and stuff, blah, blah, blah.
Attach his pay. Make him work. It's just crazy to me. I mean, I understand what you're saying about the whole outrageous amount stuff. Of course, you did that with speeding fines. Our society would never function. But that's
sure.
that's never here nor there. But really, it is pretty. My prediction is it'll get thrown out. Ultimately, Supreme Court will rule that it's ridiculous.
I think you might be right. And here's what's going to be interesting if that happens. The Supreme Court's not going to come back with a new figure, right?
Right.
They're not going to say, well, if this was $25,000, I would have bought it. But $75,000, no. you know, they're just going to say, no, this is cruel and unusual. So then that leaves the gaming commission to go back and go, okay, well, we can't do 75. Can we do 74,999?
Yeah.
Or do we have to go all the way down to $99? You know, and that's what's going to be kind of crazy about this, and that's why, you know, being a lawyer is probably a great career in our country.
It should be something like, you know, when you hold up a liquor store or whatever, you know, when you're out there doing it, and there's that whole mandatory, you commit a crime with a loaded gun, it's no matter what, it's this. Well, that's what they should do, though. They should do something like that, where it's like mandatory 1 year suspended, you know, you can't do your gambling.
Well, why not just
something like that?
You're blackballed from working in any U.S. casino.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean.
Well, I guess you can't do that in the state. I mean, I obviously can. I mean, I guess that's the problem is, you know, if this was U.S., you could do that.
Well, you're not allowed to work in this state anymore. Then
yeah,
at least
but that's probably
move,
not that
their
big
problem
deal because then you just go. I mean, particularly, and then this guy was in Western Pennsylvania, I think, so you can just go across the border to West Virginia.
Yeah, and then West Virginia's going
to
say,
it might
why,
be hard for you to
get a job. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, were you ever convicted of this crime? Yeah.
Yeah. And you tell somebody, you know, hey, your chosen career is over if you steal.
There you go.
It's not like they need the money, right?
See, we could solve everyone's problems just sitting here in our office. we don't need to have the courts involved. Just ask us what to do. We'll take care of it. It makes so much more sense. All right, you can't deal anymore in this state. Good luck trying to get a job in another state doing the same thing. This isn't Ocean's 13, okay? The guy's not going to get in underneath the Nevada Gaming Commission to run a ruse. You know what I mean? He's not getting another job if he gets fired from his job for doing that. So that's what you should do. Hey, we get to complete O'Malley's move. Very exciting. Let's refresh our memory with part one.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're playing a dealer's choice home cash game, and 50 cent, $1 crazy pineapple has been called. The table's full of a lot of good poker players. However, they like action games, so it's reasonable to assume they'll be playing this game to lose. Fortunately, we are finally on the button in this one, with around our starting stack of $100. The game is six-handed. The under-the-gun calls. The MP makes it $3 to go. The cutoff folds. And we're on the button with the King of Clubs, Queen of Spades, Jack of Clubs. This is an interesting little hand here. We're going to raise to see just how strong the MP is and to thin the field. We make it $9 to go. The blinds fold, as does the under the gun, and we're heads up with the MP who makes the call. He's a tough opponent whose strong suit is reading players and knowing the situation and how best to play it. He sits with $75. There's roughly $20 in the pot, and the flop comes the King of Hearts, Queen of Clubs, Ten of Clubs. Interesting. The MP wastes no time in placing a $12 bet. Are we calling or raising? And what card are we mucking? Does it help your decision to know this player will run it twice if we ask? What are we going to do?
Definitely raising here. Not even a question to me.
Okay.
We have top two or a royal flush draw, depending on how we decide to play it. And I'm raising not just because we're strong, because we are, but also because I want some more information on what card to toss here.
Okay.
So if we get re-raised, I'm going to give our opponent credit for a set and have to go for the flush. If he just calls, I'm going to assume that we're ahead and stick with my two pair. And I guess the last question, the fact that he'll run it twice makes this decision easier for me. Though I'm not ready to commit to saying that I'm going to ask to run it twice. But the fact that I have that option and I know he probably will does make it a little easier.
Here's what I wrote last week. I said, if he will run it twice, I will raise here. And I want to raise to like 40. And the reason why I want to do that is because he only has like 75 and then he bet 12. If I raise to 40, he's not calling me. He's either shoving or folding. Mm. So I don't think he's going to call 40 with 50 or 60 left. So he's either going to shove or he's going to fold. And if he's going to fold, I'm not going to get any more money out of him on the turn anyway, unless he somehow improves to a hand that beats my hand. So I think I'm raising and keeping King Jack. I would definitely give up the two pair. if the hand continues, he obviously I wouldn't have to throw a card away unless he calls or shoves. So at that point, he's only got $20 left, so it doesn't even matter what I keep, really. But I want to try to just hit the open-ended straight flush draw. It's just way too juicy, and I'm probably going to need it to beat him if he actually would call that raise or shove. So that's how I feel.
That's an interesting point about, you know, if you take down the pot here, then you don't have to make this gut-wrenching decision. And maybe it's not gut-wrenching decision.
No, but it's just difficult.
You know, it's gut-wrenching when you make the wrong one and then or something hits.
So. Right.
I'm trying to – again, I mean, all the great pros say, you know, if you can try to avoid your mistakes – is how you become a good poker player. And here we will be forced to make a choice here if the hand continues, and if we can eliminate that choice, then we eliminate the chance to make a mistake.
I do feel like if somebody calls us here, even if they did call, if the hand continues at all, I don't think our two pair are good.
No,
I feel like the guy's got a straight or a set or something. So I'm gonna stick with the king jack and hope that I make my flush or royal flush or whatever straight, you know, make a bigger Broadway or something, I don't know. I think the raise that I make, if he calls, it'd be crazy to just call it. He'd have to shove. So either way, I'm committing myself to putting that guy all in. So I could even shove here, really. Makes no difference to me. I think either one's going to get the same effect. Either he's going to fold to a shove or he's going to shove on a raise. So either way. All right, well, let's hear part two and see what happens.
Hello again. What sort of hands could he have? Ace-Jack is very likely here. He could have raised with something like Ace-Jack-Jack, but maybe just called our re-raise, fearing we had a higher pocket pair. And now maybe he's expecting we've flopped a set, and he's thinking he'll get paid off. He could have flopped a set himself, and is trying to find out where we're at. We've already put $9 in, and another 12 drops us down to 79. I think we could make a raise here. We bump it up to 30 and kind of cringe when he instantly moves all in. We've lost track of his stack. But for only about another 35, we make the call. Now we've got another decision to make. He quickly pitches one of his cards into the muck. Yeah, it's either a straight or a set. If we pitch the jack, we've got top two pair. And if he has the straight, as we're assuming he does, that only gives us four outs. However, if we pitch the queen, we've got a lot more options. We pitch the queen. Our opponent tables two red tens, a flopped set, and we table our open-ended royal flush draw and top pair. "Well, you can't get the royal," he says. "I folded the ace of clubs." We ask to run it twice, and he says yes. The first turn in river come the 8 of hearts, 5 of clubs. Sweet. Round 2 comes the 6 of clubs, 4 of clubs. Even better. We scoop. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying, it's good to know your opponent's tendencies before making big decisions against them. Had he not been one to run it twice, this might have been an entirely different hand. I hope to see you on the felt.
Wow, hey, it's great when you run it twice and win both times.
That's incredible. It's not easy to do that, man.
I'll say on the forum, someone advocated shoving the flop, and not that it's a terrible idea, but I think the problem with it is that it didn't give us that crucial piece of information that we needed to decide to toss the queen.
Yeah,
if we just shoved and the guy called, and you're right. I mean, he probably was kind of committed at that point if he was going to play the hand, so we lose that bit of information, I think.
See, to me, I feel like he's not going to call. He's going to fold or he's going to shove anyway. So if I shove, he's either going to call because he's got a straight already or set, you know, or whatever. And I think that I need the king anyway. You know, I'm going to make – I have a pair of kings, and then I have the straight draw and all the other stuff. So I feel like the shove isn't a bad play. I feel like it's – you know, this guy isn't going to fold – to a raise if he's going to, you know what I mean? In other words, if he's going to call a raise, he's going to shove anyway. So if you're going to shove, he's going to call anyway. So, and if he calls the shove, he's going to have a hand that we're going to have to throw the queen anyway. I feel like that we're beat if we have to throw the queen. So the guy had a set. Was that what it was?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were behind with the two pair. So that made sense to me. I didn't think any hand could call us there that wasn't beating two pair. So a shove wouldn't have mattered anyway to me. That's just how I feel.
Interesting.
Yeah. All right, very good.
Our guest today had us rolling on the floor laughing the last time he was on the Anti-Up Poker Cast, and he's made a name for himself as one of the funniest men in poker. He's the co-host of ESPN's World Series of Poker television coverage, and he'll be making a repeat appearance at the massive Deep Stack Charity Classic at Daytona Beach Kennel Club in Daytona Beach, Florida on May 5th. We always enjoy welcoming Norman Shad to the show. Thanks for joining us very early today, Norman.
It's great to be with you. I am on the West Coast, and I have been on West Coast time even when I grew up on the East Coast. It's been extra early for me my whole life.
Well, we appreciate you rolling out of bed a little early for us. So, all right, well, let's start talking. Start by talking about the Deep Stack Charity Classic. How many charity events do you do these days, and why is it important to you to do so?
I do them anytime they call. Sometimes they don't call that often, but there's usually about a half a dozen a year. And, you know, besides the fact that it just makes sense to do charity anytime you can, it's great for the poker community. The poker community always seems to have a black eye with some of the mainstream over the past generation or longer. So for the poker community, and this is where Barry Greenstein was so great at the beginning when he used to give back his tournament winnings to charity. It's just great for the poker community to show the rest of the world that they got a pretty good heart and that they're concerned and they're willing to give money and time back. So it's great for poker.
The organizers of this event that you're coming back for in May, I mean, they just could not stop raving about you after last year's event, saying, you know, you're a terrific host. You walked around and chatted with the players the entire day. And I was in that event, and I remember seeing you walking around. And when I first heard that you weren't playing, you know, I was a little disappointed. I thought, oh, man, I want that dead money. But then I thought, you know what? This is so much better because everyone actually gets to mingle with you then. And I thought it was a great thing that you did. So do you think that role is better suited for you rather than playing? Except, of course, when the game is stud 8.
No, yeah, even as I told Scott Frank, who puts the whole thing together and does such a great job for the charity in Florida, my skills, you know, my people skills, incredibly, are better than my poker skills. And I don't have that great of people skills, but my poker skills are so bad that the best use of me is, since I'm, you know, so good looking and dress well and have such a sexy voice, I might as well walk around and just turn more people on than just sitting at one table. And as you said, people, you know, one table can pick up my dead money, but if I don't play, I think I'm more valuable to the event if I just kind of walk around and schmooze.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's switch gears and talk about the World Series now, which kicks off next month. In your opinion, how has the World Series changed over the years since you've been involved with it?
Well, obviously, it's, you know, thanks to Chris Moneymaker, it's gotten incredibly larger. No thanks to the U.S. government, it hasn't gotten as large as it should be, because if online poker were completely legal in the United States, I can't tell you how many people we'd have at the main event right now. Yeah. Instead of 7,000 or 8,000. We easily would have cracked 10,000 by now, and you know, who knows? It might have been 12,000 or 15,000, since so many people were playing online and so many people were earning their seats online. But it's just remained, you know, the most amazing gathering place of a cross section of America you can find. We always like to talk about anyone can enter and anyone can win, and from the low buy in events, which are now just 1,000, to the main event, which is 10,000. You know, it just tens of thousands of people come for that month. And there's just nothing like it in sports or in the gaming business that you're going to find.
Well, you know, I love, and I think everyone else does, your self-deprecating humor. And you always obviously talk about your poker game as being a poor poker player. But we know you're a very good player, especially when it comes to games like Omaha and Stud 8, which you made the final table last year, finishing sixth. That was your third World Series cash. So what did you learn from that experience? And are you going to continue trying to tell everybody you can't play poker when we know you can?
Well, it's actually accurate. I'm half accurate there. And actually, I used to get bothered when people told me I knew nothing about poker. And I tell them, no, I know nothing about No Limit Hold'em,
okay.
Hold'em, which unfortunately is what we broadcast and what we're analyze. I'm absolutely horrific at that game. At the other games, I'm above average.
Cool.
So, yeah, I mean, it's natural for me to be self-deprecating and self-effacing, and I've done it my whole life, and it's natural, and it makes sense because I'm terrible at most things. I'm still terrible at No Limit Hold'em and at Hold'em in general, but the other games you mentioned, Stud 8 and Omaha 8, I can play pretty well. You know, I don't mention it to a lot of people, and like you said, I've now cashed finally three times in the last 4 years. I was 0 for 12, I think, before I broke through in cashing. So I never thought I would cash because I don't play many tournaments. I don't play any tournaments for the rest of the year. So it was a great thrill to cash the first time, and then to make a final table last year was really beyond my expectations or dreams.
Did you learn anything from that experience, though? I mean, is it like if you get to that point again, is it something you'll do differently to try to take the bracelet?
Oh, yeah. You know, I learned a lot more from the tournament. I think it was a $10,000 stud eight championship last year just before when I cashed, when we were down to 30 players and that was only paying 24 spots. I made a lot more mistakes than I usually do. And I also don't know, there's a difference between tournament play and cash play. And I don't play enough tournaments. I don't get enough reps to remember what I learned.
Yeah.
So I was just telling a friend of mine the other day, saying, I guess you're looking forward to playing this year. I said, yeah, but, you know, I haven't played any tournaments since last year's World Series, and you really need reps, just like in anything else. You remember the little nuances of things that you got to do differently and different bets to save and different things that you do when you get down towards the bubble. And so I learned a lot. The problem is that I think I forgot most of it. And I also learned that I don't give you a bracelet for sixth place. I was asking. I was wandering around. I think this is my bracelet. I mean, I finished sixth place. Statistical improbability. When am I going to get here again? And they just they validated my parking and asked me to leave the premises.
Oh, man. What events do you plan to play this year? Or do you just kind of pick and choose based on your schedule?
Yeah, I play mixed events. I don't play any hold'em events. So I looked at the schedule again. I usually play two or three, and I hope to play four this year. Again, I'll play the event that I finished in the final table last year, which is the Stud 8 Omaha 8 mix. I'll play a couple of Stud 8s or an Omaha 8, and I hope to play the 1500 horse, which is probably my favorite event because you're just going to get, you don't get to play Raz on a daily basis. unless you're doing time upstate and they have nothing else to do. And you can convince them to play Raz because you really want to win their cigarettes. So I love playing horse. I wish I could play horse cash, and it just doesn't happen that often. So it'll be a Stud 8 Omaha 8 horse trifecta for me.
You know, some of our listeners have wondered, what effect, if any, will the emergence of live stream coverage have on the ESPN television broadcast this year?
You know, it's weird. The 2 years ago, we did the live stream on the main event for the first time, and a lot of people in the poker community were really, really happy with that. And then they did not do it last year. I think it was partly an impact on the ratings on the Tuesday night tape production. So I do not believe they're doing the live stream again this year for the main event. I'm not completely sure about that.
Okay.
But I think we're going back, other than live streaming. Well, maybe we're not live streaming anything this year during the World Series. I think we're going back to the taped production for a while. I know some people are looking for poker to evolve more to where they can get it live streamed. The more casual viewer generally is not interested in that. It's a long haul, unless you've like changed poker, I believe. Where they need a shot clock or quicker structures to make it closer to like a basketball or football game, not a baseball game. Those never end. It's closer to a 2 or 3 hour thing. It's just hard to lock into a 6 or 8 hour thing. And of course, last year for the main event final table, we had record setting. We had 11 hours of three handed play, which nobody's really happy with. It's fascinating from a small standpoint, and I was happy for the three guys because they were such good players and they handled themselves so well over that time. But in general, nobody really wants to commit that much time to anything. That was longer than my second marriage. So I just think there's have to be some changes to make live stream more part of the mainstream.
Yeah, let me ask you one more follow-up question on that, because I think a lot of our listeners had this ongoing debate where the live streaming is, as you mentioned, great for the hardcore poker nuts that just want to see every single hand. But it's absolutely devastating, in my opinion, to the casual viewer, which I think we're slowly losing. When we had that big poker boom where we had everybody out playing poker every night in the home games, and what do you think is going to be the next thing that we need to do to get that casual viewer back?
Well, first of all, again, when the poker boom happened, guys, it was a three-pronged thing. It was, Chris Moneymaker, it was the World Series of Poker and the World Poker Tour going on television at the same time, and the third and critical element was online poker, which obviously didn't exist a generation ago. If you get online poker back, Online poker, you know, served two audiences. It served the hardcore people. It served people who play professionally for a living. But a lot of people got into poker for the first time casually. Even a lot of older people who just did it like an hour a night. It was like a companion to them. It was like watching television. Instead of watching television, they'd sit down and play the low limit thing, you know, without having to leave their house. So if you bring online poker back, that alone helps bring the casual viewer back. I just think online poker, and I don't even play online, and I have problems with certain things online, but online poker has been a critical component of the poker boom we saw that started in 2003.
Yeah, I think we all agree on that. That's just, it's so important these days. I always wonder too, if they keep passing state by state, if eventually the feds will just come in and say, you know what, we got to get this money ourselves, and then finally pass it. So
no, they will. It's anything in Washington takes a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, if you had a bill that just supported motherhood or said the sky is blue, that's a four-year process. So eventually, you will have online poker federally. It'll be legal. It'll be federally regulated, taxed, and all that, as it should be. Because
yeah.
It's there's no reason people shouldn't be able to do it in the first place. And in the second place, you know, they're losing a lot of money that they would be getting from the taxes. So I can't believe it, that eventually money speaks. And in this case, it's just taking longer than usual.
Yeah. All right, on a little more serious note, how much longer are you going to allow Lon McCarron to ride your coattails?
You know, it's sad on several fronts. I'm sad you brought that up because we're on a public forum here. But, you know, a couple of years ago, he was on crutches. He didn't even have any type of leg problem. He went on crutches because he's just looking for sympathy, looking for people to walk up to him at the World Series because no one talks to him. So, yeah, he's ridden the coattails, which is pretty bad because I wear a pretty old coat. And it's pretty worn, so he shouldn't be doing that. And third of all, you know, it's just one of the hidden secrets of the difficulty of the production. The most difficulty of the production is sobering him up before we tape. And just, you know, wheeling him in after another bender with Jack Daniels, or I think like Tennessee Cognac, and just get him in there, you know, just kind of drying him out, you know, throwing cold water in his face, and then that stupid booming voice comes out. And then every once in a while I get to say somebody was bamboozled. That's pretty much the process. I'm a little tired of it, but, you know, it's been 10 years of him, as you mentioned, and you said it, I didn't say it, I'll say it now, I'm riding my coattails. Jeez, with this guy.
Oh, man.
He does bowling now, okay? In bowling, he's out at sea, okay? He knows less about bowling than he does poker, and he doesn't have me next to him to, you know, save him. He's got a bowler next to him, a bowler who barely speaks English, I believe. So, you know.
Hey, but at least he has a BBA. Shouldn't you have a backup plan, too?
Do I have a backup?
Well, I mean, he's got the PBA. What do you have?
Oh, no, he's in much better shape than I am. I have no backup plan. You know, my backup plan is go to 7-Eleven and hopefully they give me incorrect change on the big gulp and I make a dime.
Oh, man.
All right, well, Norman, aside from you, of course, who are some of the funniest people in poker these days?
Some of the funniest people in poker?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, inadvertently, always, Phil Hellmuth is one of the funniest people in poker. He's just, you know, that, you know, I dodge bullets, baby, and you can't even spell poker. You can't script that stuff any better than he thinks of it off the top of his head. Because, you know, he's so sick at the poker table, he just can't take beats. He can't take bad play around him. So he's inadvertently one of the funniest people in poker. On the broadcasting end, you know, I love listening to Joe Stapleton, who I don't even get to hear anymore because he's either in Europe or he's on live streaming that I don't watch.
Yeah.
But Joe Stapleton, I like to think he's a protege of mine, but he's better than me, so he's not even a protege of mine. He's just better than me. So he's really funny when he's talking on poker. And then as far as the live players go, again, I like good talk. And, you know, even though he's not necessarily funny all the time, you can't get any better talk than Daniel Negreanu around the table. He still, to me, is the, you know, the poster boy to how you handle yourself, particularly when you're a younger player. He learned to do that before he was 30. Just how to handle yourself with other people at the table, TV cameras or no TV cameras. You know, friendly. You know, you make people want to give you their money. He's friendly. He welcomes other people. He talks to other people. He picks up information when he does that. But besides that, it's just the right attitude to have around the poker table instead of berating everybody or, you know, running into Sam Grizzle and saying, all right, do you want to go five rounds in here or do you want to go five rounds in the parking lot? That isn't good for poker. It's good for poker to be friendly and accommodating and, you know, bring more people in under the tent. And Danny Negreanu learned that, you know, by the time he was 25.
Yeah, you know, one of the knocks now is that poker has been taken over by the young kids, and a lot of them
are brash and in your face, like you mentioned. Are there some young players that you've noticed that break out of that mold and seem to have a little bit more respect for the game?
Yeah, again, I think that knock against them is not always fair to them, because the older players, before the poker boom began, and when I first walked into I didn't walk into a card room until 1998 or 1999. I was 40 years old by then. It was a very unfriendly place to walk into. The older players, you know, they didn't understand how to do business. You know, they would berate you. They'd blow smoke in your face. They're driving away the donkeys and the fish. Why would you try to make somebody who's going to give you their money be uncomfortable? The younger players, the online players, generally, you know, they lack social skills, as they're going to. They haven't lived long enough. They've lived too long of their life in front of a computer screen with a mouse, you know, multi-tabling this and that. So when they come out into the real world, they're not always very talkative. You know, a lot of them aren't brash or in your face. They're just kind of quiet, and they're not very welcoming to you. So I don't think they get sort of a bad rap. They just don't have the social skills they should have. So I love the guys I see that come out there and do have great social skills. You know, a guy like Scott Seaver, who's just, you know, he's sort of a mini Danny Negreanu. He's very friendly at the table. You know, when he's losing, he handles it very well. So you have a bunch of guys out there that I like to see, and Scott's one of them. William Reynolds is another young guy who I like to see at the table. He's very friendly and talkative. So, again, a lot of the younger ones need to go to school on that and understand that you do need to be a little more social. You don't want to hide under the hoodie and under the headsets and just be like an Autotron. It just doesn't welcome people to the table, and so you got to be a little more, I'd say, like a person.
Yeah.
You know, you're playing with other people. It's different when you're in front of that. When you're on that, you know, when I watch people play online, I watch friends of mine play online, I just look at that stupid chat box at the bottom, the conversation that goes on there.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And people somehow feel entitled or enabled even more when they're anonymous and they're sitting, you know, in their pajamas and they say anything they want in that little comment box. So they've spent too much time just in front of the computer. They got to come out and learn that when you're not in front of the computer, you got to deal with other people, and you got to be a little more of a person, a real person.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned the poker brat earlier. How about setting the line for us and telling us how you think Phil Hellmuth will enter the World Series main event this year?
Yeah. Most people hope they enters on a stretcher or in a coffin. But, you know, I'm sympathetic to Phil. I don't know how, you know, he might be done with that, because last year, you know, he does that definitely for the TV. You know, most things he doesn't do for TV. He's, you know, naturally the way he is without the cameras. But I don't think we did much with the, you know, because we don't cover day one and day two anymore.
Yeah.
We do highlights. So I think he might have stopped that last year. And again, I he's great for me, because he's easy to, you know, when he's on TV, it's, you know, I always feel like I should give him 10% of my paycheck. He doesn't need the money. But, you know, I like to defend him on two fronts. Away from the table, you know, he's a really nice guy. You know, he's just out of his mind at the table. He loses his mind because he just hasn't learned how to, you know, deal with people who play poorly or play worse than he does. He's a really nice guy. And second of all, you know, I defend him with the young online guys, as far as, you know, he's been under fire for the last few years about how stupid he plays. I don't know the strategy involved here, because they're playing at, you know, different types of approaches. But his tournament results, you know, even during the online boom, are unmatched.
Yeah.
So they can make fun of him all they want about how badly he's playing, but his results are just incredible at the World Series of Poker. It's not just back in the small fields and when they used to play at a different, you know, a very simpler level. He is really, you know, he's made some adjustments, and plus he plays well, incredible release. His results are really good, even outside of Hold'em, you know. So
yeah.
He finally won his first non-Hold'em bracelet last year. So they can make fun of him all he wants. You know, all he has to do is look at the 13 bracelets, look at the 90 caches, where he's up to. You know, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, since Phil's not going to make an entrance this year, or may not, it sounds like, I think there's an opening for you, Norman, isn't there? I mean, do you have a grand way of entering the World Series this year that could get people talking?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it'll get people talking, but since they've done so much for me, the three or four divorce lawyers I've had over the years, they should just come in, you know, like, instead of babes, I'll just come in with the divorce lawyers. Like, one of them got me to avoid alimony on marriage number one. You know, second one introduced me to my third wife, who I'm still married to, so that's pretty good. So, yeah, I think, you know, because we people don't, you know, people make fun of, like, insurance claims adjusters and tax guys and divorce lawyers. I've had some really top-notch guys, so maybe I'll come in with them.
Okay, last question. Last time you were on our show, we discussed you and the American Mustache Institute. Have you ever considered adding a soul patch or some other facial hair variation?
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up. I always forget about the American Mustache Institute. And the other day, my stepdaughter, who's 14 years old, was online looking for something, and she said, "Why would the American Mustache Institute interview you?" I go, "You know, I forgot about that, Mia, but first of all, look at it. I got the mustache." No, guys, I do not like to shave, so I used to have a beard that's really scraggly, and half the reason I have a mustache is I don't like to shave. I don't have the beard because it makes me look even worse. It used to make me look like Yasser Arafat. You remember him? Really good poker player.
Yes.
Actually, he's the original PLO guy. So I look even worse with a beard. So if I didn't have to go out at any point of the day, I would never shave. But I look so bad with other facial hair, you're never going to see me with a beard or a goatee or one of those little things under your lip, which I don't know.
That's a soul patch.
That's what you call it.
Yeah.
I've never understood that thing, by the way.
Looks like you had lunch and
I'm more likely to get a tongue ring than a soul patch, and I'm not getting a tongue ring anytime soon. But thanks for the thought.
Okay.
Oh man, use the original PLO. That's going to keep me cracking up for a while, Norman. That's a good one.
Hey, I hadn't thought of that one before. I'll see if I can bring that up in the poker telecast. I don't think it's going to come at any point in the main event, but yeah. I forgot about y'all.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's going to kill, particularly for the more academic of your viewers. All right, well, thank you so much for joining us, Norman. I know you probably won't get it back to bed, so we're not going to hold you up any longer. But before you leave, do remind our listeners the many ways they can keep in touch with you right now.
The many ways they can keep in touch with me?
Yeah, Twitter, you know, whatever else you're doing out there.
All right, first of all, I'm listed in the phone book, so you can call me at any time. Very few people are still listed in the phone book, especially in Los Angeles. There's virtually no Anglo-Americans listed in the phone book. If you go to the Los Angeles phone book, it's like 8,000 Asian names, and then one guy named like Lon McCarron. That's it. But yeah, I'm still at Twitter at Norman Chad. Simple Twitter, and I don't like to tweet, but I tweet often enough that it's amazing. Every time you tweet, you lose 10 followers. You never tweet, people keep following you, and every time I put out a tweet, I see that people go, "What the hell is this guy talking about?" And they just get rid of you. They go, "This guy's really an idiot," and they get rid of you. So I'm trying to tweet less so more people will follow me. But yeah, I try to keep a low profile, Scott and Chris, because if I keep a high profile, people just take a baseball bat to your head. So yeah, I would just follow me at Twitter, and then if you do see me in 7-Eleven, I'll buy a Jack Link's beef jerky.
And to our listeners, don't forget, Norman will be at the Deep Stack Charity Classic in Daytona Beach, May 4th and 5th. Norman, thanks so much for joining us today.
I hope to see you all in Daytona Beach if you're there.
Absolutely. Take care.
All right, guys.
All right, bye-bye.
Hey, this is AJ Benzing.
This is Justin Bonomo.
This is Downtown Chad Brown.
Hi, this is Clinique Allen.
This is Daniel Negreanu.
Hey, this is David Singer.
This is Linda Johnson.
Hi, this is Greg Raymer.
Hi, this is Hoyt Corkins.
Hi, this is Cindy Violet.
Hi, this is John D'Agostino.
This is Joe Seabach.
This is Jennifer Harmon.
Yeah, this is Johnny Chan.
This is Cowboy Kenna James.
Hi, this is Mark Safe.
This is Paul Wasikin.
Hi, this is Miami Johnson.
This is Dora Brunson, and you're listening to Annie Up.
All right, we've got an online hand, Chris.
What's that?
Haven't had too many of those.
I don't even know what that means anymore.
And it is a Limit Omaha High-Low game, so you're in purgatory right now.
Oh, man.
Comes from a longtime listener, Jeff from Fox River Grove, Illinois.
Cool.
Always kind of wanted to live in a cool town like that. Fox River... What is it again? Fox River Grove.
You live in a cool named town.
Well, that's true, yeah. And part of the reason I moved there is because of that town name.
Yeah, there you go.
Sense, but Fox River. So, is it the Fox River?
I don't know.
Or are there foxes in River Grove? That's what I want to know. So many questions. All right. So Jeff is in a full ring, nine-handed, 50-cent dollar Limit Omaha high-low game.
Okay.
I'm playing for a few hours, and we have the obligatory running the $20 buy up to $32.58.
Nice.
Now we have everybody at the table covered. After the two larger stacks left in orbit earlier, one of the new players has been very aggressive pre-flop, in the few hands played, resulting in no one seeing a flop for 50 cents since he arrived. On the action, I'm dealt ace of hearts, ace of spades, nine of diamonds, six of spades, and let's see, the end of the gun, under gun plus one, had limped, and then a middle position player raises, another caller, and we're on the button with that hand again, which again is ace of hearts, ace of spades, nine of diamonds, six of spades.
All right, so we got one nut flush draw and a pair of aces in a limit high-low game. I'll call. I'm not going to raise again. I don't see any reason to raise again here. I'm not even playing. I'm playing for half the pot, essentially. And it could turn out that it's not half the pot. It could turn out we scoop or something. But really, you want to play hands that scoop. And a lot of times, the low gets there. So I don't see any reason to push it anymore. Let's just try to get in for a nice cheap flop with aces, because you're not going to get anybody to fold here. So you might as well just get in for the cheap price.
I don't think you're trying to get me to fold. It's just a matter of building a pot for when you hit your hand.
Yeah.
So I could make a case for raising, but at the same time, I'm fine with not either. And just because here's the thing, if you don't, then you are disguising your hand, which is beneficial at times.
Yeah.
No one's really going to put you on aces if you didn't raise here. But at the same time, aces are overrated in limit Omaha high low, of course, but we do have, you know, flush possibility. You also have this weird straight possibility, which is going to get us in trouble. So, I definitely probably think I would just call here. But if somebody wanted to raise, I am not going to criticize them.
Yeah. Again, like you said, a lot of times people raise in this game because they have ace deuce in their hand, not aces. There is sort of a disguise there that if it comes all high cards and you raise, they're going to think you have ace deuce and they're going to try to bet in you or whatever. But I can't tell you how many times I had ace and two raggedy cards, although he does have one that's suited. But I mean, really, you raise with it thinking, all right, I got aces. I can't be beat right now. I'm ahead. And the flop comes and you're like in 18th place at a five table person table. So,
right. Yeah.
I like just calling, but I wouldn't fault anybody for raising either. If you really felt like you could, I would want to narrow this. See, I don't know. I don't want to build a pot really, because more people are going to want to be in and with their connectors and everything.
Other advantage to raising is you get rid of some of the weaker low hands. You know, you might drive out like an ace three or ace four, some of those, and you know, it's possible, obviously, in this game that not everybody, you know, it's not every hand that somebody has ace deuce, you know. So it's possible that you can drive out some of those better low hands. And the difference with this hand is it does have scoop potential, because if a low doesn't come, we've got a strong high.
Right.
Whereas if we just play a bunch of low cards, then really we are not playing for the scoop, we're playing for the low only. So. If the slop comes with three high cards, then we're in a scoop material at that point. So.
Yeah, and we do have sort of a backdoor crappy low. You know, if it
yeah, and I guess that's what I was getting at, is that if you can get rid of some of these weaker lows, then you might back into it with a 61.
Yeah,
I'm not going to hang my hat anywhere on it, but it's nice to have in your back pocket, and you can get somebody to fold. But really, if I'm raising, I'm raising to build a pot, not so much driving anybody out here.
All right, what happens?
All right, well, Hero decides that the raiser might have aces too, but his raising range is just too wide to put him on just that. He could just easily be raising with some other big pair or rundown or big double-suited hand. Since I have half the aces and want to drive out junky lows and the blinds that could beat me for the low pot, I decide to 3-bet and raise it to 150.
Mm-hmm.
All right. He says this has the desired effect of getting the blinds to fold. The first two limpers call, and the initial raiser caps it to $2, and the player in between us calls. It's back to us. Obviously, we're gonna put this 50 cents in. Right, he's asking fold or call, but I might have to fly all the way to Fox River Grove, Illinois, and slap him.
Yeah, we aren't folding for 50 cents, but
yeah.
I know the desired effect to get the blinds out is hilarious, because you still got 145 other callers.
Yeah.
So I would want at that point, let's keep the blinds in and make more money. But yeah, we're calling the 50 cents.
All right. So our hero says this is an obvious call. Good. And the other players feel the same as well, too. So five of us seeing the flop, with 10.75 in the pot before the rake. And the flop is Trey of Clubs, Seven of Spades, Jack of Clubs.
All right, we got those backdoor things. Yeah, well, I mean, we got those backdoor things, and we got an overpair. But again, it's
likely a low is going to get there, and ours isn't great. I am actually not very excited about this flop.
No. I mean, what really, there's nothing to be excited about. If it was all high cards, even if it was all high cards, now you're looking at Broadway kind of stuff that's, you can't ever make a Broadway now. Right. So I would have liked, like, 9-8, you know, Jack or something, because then at least, all right, my aces could still be good at that point. I don't know if anyone's actually playing Queen 10, maybe. Yeah, maybe
9-8 Queen would be better.
Yeah.
or 9-8 King.
9-8 King, there you go. Something like that, where someone might think their ace King is good, or, you know, no straight's going to get there on the next one, and the low has to go runner-runner, that kind of thing. This one, any low card just screws us. And, you know, somebody could have Jack-Jack in their hand. Sets could be there. So aces now just shrivel right up to me. But, again, there's 10.75 out there. So if it's like 1 50-cent bet, I'm going to call and try to improve my hand on the turn and see if another spade comes or another ace. If the ace gets there, yeah, okay, somebody's got a low, but you've got the nut set then. So
wow.
Let's just call, I think, if somebody bets.
You know what? I am going to strongly advocate folding to any bet here.
For 50 cents and a $10.75.
Here's the problem. I mean, to improve our high, we're going to need to hit an ace.
Mm-hmm.
We hit an ace. Now a low is out there. Now, of course, that ace is probably going to obliterate some lows, but with so many people in the hand, somebody's got a low. And we won't at that point. We'll have to get another low card to even have a live six. So at that point, we're splitting the pot. And that's on a two outer to split the pot. It just doesn't make much sense to me. Now the only other way I think we can win this is if a spade peels off, and hopefully a high spade. But then we're gonna have to put in another round of betting, hoping we hit the flush draw, and that's just problematic for me as well too. So, you know, we had a pretty crappy Omaha 8 hand. I mean, the aces are nice, but there's really nothing else in our hand versus it. You know, we put the pressure on, we tried to build a pot and thin the field a little bit, and then the flop just didn't work for us. So, you know, we're on the button, so maybe if we're closing out, maybe I can throw, again, it's 50 cents, that's the problem. I mean, if we're playing at stakes that mean something to me, then it'd be tougher. 50 cents, I may put it in there. But really, I don't know what we were hoping for at that point, after that. And we're almost hoping for runner, runner, no low cards with an ace or spades. That's a lot to ask out of this hand.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's take the Omaha part of this out of it. Let's say you were doing the dog and pony show with Faso and limit hold'em. And you raise and he 3-bet and then you capped it and he calls and you just had ace king and he just had 10-10 and the flop comes jack high and you, what do? You're betting
out. First of
out.
All, I go, jack high!
Yeah, you bet out because it's so much money. Or let's say Faso bets out. You're not folding for one bet. It's been capped, and you only have two cards in your hand. And you only, I know you have, what, 3-6 outs in your mind because you have ace-king. But still, ace-king is a good hand in that game. And you would not fold for one bet. Now you're looking at 21.5-1 on your money for a 50-cent bet to try to pick up either a two-outer or a backdoor flush draw that's a nut flush draw. And if it's a high spade, the low hasn't gotten there yet, and now you can pump it. If you really can get away with trying to call for just 50 cents, I think you're calling for 50 cents in our home game.
All right, let me give you another scenario. I think if you're going to continue to play this hand, I think you need to raise.
Okay, well, I don't have a problem with that. I'm just saying.
Here's the thing, because at this point, I mean, this is actually not a bad flop to try to get isolated with this one guy who apparently is what raising range is really wide and seems to be very aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have a terrific hand, as I just mentioned, which is why I would think about folding. But raising now you're signifying to the table that this guy that led the action is strong. And you believe you're stronger than him. There's two low cards. Unless somebody's got ace deuce and has some other possibility for the high, or they're just completely stupid and think that it's worth drawing to just to have, you're going to get those people out and might end up heads up with this guy. And at that point, then your aces might be good if he's playing some junk stuff. And if he doesn't really have a good low and a low gets there, your ace six might hold up against one opponent, certainly not against five. And knowing that he's aggressive, he's probably going to pump it again, and the other players probably know that as well, too. So I think that's more likely you're going to get at least those two middle players out of this hand if you raise them.
And I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem folding. Raising is fine to me, too, because you're still getting 10 to 1 on your money if you make it a dollar. 10 to 1 on my money to try to hit a backdoor flush draw and another ace, or even my aces could still be good against somebody pumping with ace-deuce here. You know, ace-deuce of clubs could be pumping the hell out of this hand now, and that's fine with me because, you know...
Well, that's fine with me all the time if ace-deuce thinks that they should be betting this.
That's what I'm thinking, you know. But that's, you know, we don't know what we're up against. We're playing in a 50-cent dollar game, so...
All right, so I'll say this. I would say this is a raise or fold. Calling, I don't think, is... I think calling, you're losing value in this hand by calling. Now, I guess 50 cents if that's the case, but... I really think your better plays are one or the other.
Okay, well, I advocate one or the other, raise or call. I don't fold at all. I just can't fold this hand.
All right, well, then we should probably raise it. But so that's the only thing we agree on.
So let's raise then. But we don't even know what happened. I'm just saying if it gets to us and it's bad.
That's right, we don't even know what the action is.
I don't even know what happened.
We've already decided what we're doing.
Yeah, what the hell happened?
All right, so our hero says, okay, this isn't a terrible flop.
That's not great.
Not terrible, but yeah, it's... I mean, there's some other choice adjectives for it. I have a non-nut low draw, an overpair, and a backdoor nut flush draw, and a long shot backdoor straight draw. None of those are very exciting. No. Particularly the long shot, I'm going to pause here and say the backdoor straight draw, because to get there, you're going to have to get, a low is going to be on the board at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's actually not something I'm really excited about. All right, so the first two players checks, the person that's leading the action does bet. Gets out the player in between us, and now it's to us. We've already discussed this ad nauseum. We're going to raise, but let's see what he does. He says, I decide there's far too much money in the pot and a little chance of being whipsawed, and decide to call for the 50 cents, and the other two players call as well.
Well, you know, that's the thing, is that I said either call or raise, and if he knew he wasn't going to whipsawed, maybe you just try to take a flyer and pick up your flush draw. But if something scary comes, like a four clubs, you know, or something like that, I'm out of there. So I don't mind calling the 50 cents if I knew the guys behind me would just call. That's the thing, is how do you know that? So raising, maybe you get them out if they were just going to call. So the raise is probably still the best play.
Okay, so the turn card is the seven of diamonds. So our board now is tray of clubs, seven of spades, jack of clubs, seven of diamonds. And I actually kind of dismissed this possibility, and probably one more reason to raise, because now our two-pair actually beats anybody else's two-pair.
Yeah.
Of course, if somebody has a seven, then we're in trouble, but it does help our hand a little bit.
Yeah, it's weird.
But not against four-hand. Four-hands now, it's much more likely somebody else has a seven.
And I really don't feel like a boat got there, because someone would have been raising there. Of course, the first person could have hit a boat.
First person would
have hit 50 cents, but still.
Absolutely.
You know,
of course, then again, I don't go crazy with a set of trays on this board either. So,
right.
You know, I just see how things go. So,
that's true too. But I don't like that card though. I don't like that card. I would have rather seen like a queen of spades or something. But I don't like that card at all. Now I guess it gets back to the feeling. If somebody bets out a dollar again,
but here's the thing: is that we really thought, for the most part, they were going to have to hit our two outer here.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that, nothing's
spade.
Changed about that.
Right,
and,
or
yeah,
a spade,
lost
too.
A spade now,
yeah.
Right?
So. And that didn't happen either. So I think I'm done with this hand, believe it or not, unless they...
See? And I would have saved 50 cents.
Yeah, you would have saved 50 cents.
Or actually, I would have cost myself that.
Can't be results-oriented, buddy.
All right, with the 1275 in the pot, the first two players check. A player that has been leading the action, predictably, as he says, fires a dollar. Call, fold, or raise for us.
I think I'm folding. I mean, the only way I would not fold and is to raise. And if I were to raise, it's because I absolutely 100% believe the people behind me would fold, and this guy was on a low draw and just crazy, you know, still with the nut flush draw or something in the clubs. That's the only way I would play this hand. If I would firmly believe that I'm going to get these two tight wads behind me out by raising, I might consider that. Now, again, if I had raised on the street before, I would certainly consider it, because now I've given this impression that I've now bowed it or something. So the other guys aren't going to stick around to hit a low to win half the pot when I'm going to keep pumping it up and they might get quartered or something. So I guess it just depends on how I would have played the flop versus how he played it. But given the way he played it and that we just called and now a guy's still firing at us, unless I got a real strong feeling the guys are going to fold behind me, I can get away for, you know, that this guy's going low only and my aces are good, I'm getting out of this hand. So I'm probably folding.
Yeah, I would have rather raised on the flop. There's probably a case to be made for raising here, too, because if no one else has a 7, then they're going to be scared. I mean, nothing really changes in the sense of the reason that we would raise on the flop is really to play off the fact that we have an aggressive player in the hand already.
Yeah.
And those players in between us know that they're not just calling our raise. They're probably going to have to end up calling 2 bets, and that's going to get them out, which is what we were trying to do at that point. Now, it still could work here, but it's going to be more expensive for us, and so I would have rather done it on the flop. But I could almost make a case for raising here and trying to represent that we had a naked 7 in our hand with something better. And maybe this guy is just aggressive and was just trying to win this pot. And at that point, you know, maybe the low-hanger honors know they have one card left now, which kind of changes it in your mind.
Hmm. Well, the other thing, too, is if we had raised, we were given the indication that we might have had top set pre-flop, or after the flop, I mean. And so now a raise would make sense. It continues to tell the story that I have now filled up, and you're crazy to go for the low, or if you think your 3-3 in your hand is good because I'm raising, you know, you might get out with a baby boat or something. So there is, like you said, there is that case there where you can get heads up with somebody you think is going low, and then you'll take the high, and the low doesn't even get there. Now you scoop it, so... I think there is a way to do it, but just got to really... I think telling our story initially, raising after the flop would have been able to help it. Now a raise is kind of suspicious.
Yeah, here, I really can't advocate a call at this point, I don't think.
No, it's either a raise
it's
or
a fold or a raise now.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, so our hero decided there's just too much money in the pot not to call. I'm only dead to a jack or a 7 or pocket trays. If my villain has one of those, I'll be sick. I hate that I can't narrow his range, and this line could be anything from pure nuts to a bluff. So we call. The end of the gun folds. Wow, what happened here? We missed some more information.
Well, wait a minute. Did you jump ahead? Because you said he was dead to a jack. How could he be dead to a jack?
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed it. I did. All right. I'm sorry. All right.
I think we know what the river is then.
Yeah, so bring it about that. Alright, I think this card is likely a blank. If the other two guys had flopped a set, they would have bet the flop to protect it, right? Well, not if it's a tray. Maybe not even a 7, to be honest. And our middle position villain, I just can't give him credit for having anything that beats me. It's possible he or one of the other callers has a 7, but as I feel as though my low draw is still live. Yeah. I don't know about that.
I don't know about that either.
But I feel like a raise isn't going to chase away a better low draw. I think it might. I decided to call. Under the gun calls, but we lose one of the other players. And now we're 3 players to the river, which we have no idea what it's going to be. Oh my gosh, I'm surprised it's a jack of hearts.
Yeah.
So our final board is the trade club, 7 of spades, jack of clubs, 7 of diamonds, jack of hearts, 1575 in the pot. The end of the gun player checks, and our villain fires the last bullet.
You know what, for $16 to get $1 and there's no low, what the hell? What the hell? I mean, I don't think he had a 7. He wasn't betting a 7 before. He might have bet a jack. He might have bet a jack. But he could have been just pumping the low, or he could have had kings or queens. Yeah. So for $1 to win 16, yeah, I'm calling. I only have to be right 1 in 15 times or whatever it is. So.
Yeah, the only fear is that the third player in this hand actually was doing one of those, I'm not going to bet the river and hope somebody bets it so I can raise. Yeah,
even then, it only cost you a
craptastic things.
Yeah.
Right. So, but really, at this point, the way this hand has played out, I really kind of think this under the gun is was on the low draw and he missed and has no interest in it. So you're right. For $1, again, this is you put $1 in, you only have to be right 1 in 16 times.
Yeah.
Or let's say 15 times.
Yeah.
Profitable here.
I'm calling the book.
It just kind of, it's not fun making the call here, but this is kind of what you do.
That's what happens in limit. I mean, that's you have to deal with both sides of that. You get to reap the benefits when, you know, it's only a dollar to win 16, and you lose the benefits of trying to protect your hand when it's only a dollar to bluff 16. So,
true.
So hey, I'm taking advantage of it and calling the book.
Okay, well, this will be a surprise, but you said there's so much in the pot, money in the pot, not the call. He's only dead to a jack or a seven, or pocket trays. If my villain has one of those, I'll be sick. Boy, it's sick twice in this hand.
Man.
I hate that I can't narrow his range, and this line could be anything from pure nuts to a bluff. The other gun player folds, which I take to be a very good sign. And our villain shows queen of hearts, deuce of hearts, ace of diamonds, four of diamonds.
There you go. He's pumping the nut low.
Yep.
Didn't get there.
And, you know, hey, this is why I love Lemon Omaha 8. I mean, I would be in this. I would invite this game to my this guy to my home. I might even pay for his travel expenses.
I thought when you said Queen of Hearts, you were going to say another Queen. I really did. But the Ace Deuce does not surprise me. And the 4 now, he's got that. He can't lose the low, really. Unless it went runner-runner somehow. But even then, he'd still. But, yeah, that's. Yeah, but wow.
What
guy.
Did he have for. He had, like, really nothing for high, right? Queen, ace.
Backdoor wheel.
Yeah, but not on the turn at that point.
No, not on the turn.
Pair or anything, yeah. So, yeah, he got a little too frisky there. And,
yeah,
he paid the price.
Paid specifically for that price. So, wow, so the whole way, and we end up getting rewarded for that. That's crazy.
Yeah. Wow. All right, Jeff, we've recently sent you something, so nothing for you this week, but remind everybody else to send your hands of the week to podcast at antiupmagazine.com, and if we're using the show, we'll send you something wonderful like a deck of J-Design playing cards, official playing cards of Annie Up. Pick up your own decks in the Annie Up store at antiupmagazine.com/shop, and don't forget to support J-Design's new Kickstarter campaign for its new line of cards by visiting kickstarter.com and searching for J-Design, which is spelled D-E-S-J-G-N. And he's just announced some more colors.
Sweet.
So definitely check out the Kickstarter campaign and see that, and help our good friend out.
All right. I want to thank Norm and Chad for just a hilarious interview, and I really hope he considers the soul patch. I'm Chris Cosenza.
I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.